Therefore, this is a shame for those who continue to normalize ties with this enemy that continues to launch the most heinous assaults with their artillery and bullets. Thousands of wounded people have lost their eyesight, and many of them lost one eye or two. Hundreds of wounded people fell in the past assault. We will eventually pray in Al-Quds, no matter how long it takes.
Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General also stressed that Al-Quds is not merely a piece of land. It is rather an international humane cause. And Imam Khomeini established a cultural, ethical, and religious system to liberate it.
Mizatul Imam.
Imam Khomeini did not only make a declaration, he put a roadmap for the liberation of Palestine. He did not only call on the people to hold commemorations and events and make speeches to celebrate a day for Al-Quds, he directly closed the Israeli embassy and opened the Palestinian embassy. He founded Al-Quds Brigade as part of the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, which would begin to form the army of 20 million. This would extend to the rest of the region and would support resistance inside Palestine. The only objective is to liberate Palestine.
All the speakers at the conference agreed that those who believe in the Palestinian cause are convinced more than ever that Al-Quds in Palestine will be liberated. International Quds Day has developed from being a day of solidarity and vocal support to being a day of practical coordination between the resistance factions. The Resistance Alliance has for once ratified a unified strategy of defense, and the focal point is Al-Quds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Hundreds of thousands of refugees continue to flow into the European Union from Ukraine. The EU is providing residency permits, access to the labour market, housing, medical assistance, and free education for children for a period of at least 1 year. Now the European Commission has unveiled plans to make these benefits permanent.
This is happening as de facto we're having 5 million Ukrainian refugees in our member states.
The European Commission's new initiative is called the Legal Migration Policy.
Could be used, for example, for employers and member states to find Ukrainian teachers that they need to employ to help for the Ukrainian children.
Critics are incensed as they look back at how the EU closed its borders to refugees fleeing conflicts in the Middle East and Africa that the West helped to create. 26-year-old William Ibrahim now lives in Brussels, having left his native country, Syria. He says the EU has a legal responsibility to treat all refugees the same.
Regardless where is the refugee come from or what is his race or his color, his religion, we just be fair to him.
Relations between the EU and Russia over the conflict in Ukraine have gotten even worse. Moscow has cut off gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria for not paying in Russian rubles.
The latest aggressive move from Russia is another very stark reminder that we need to work with reliable partners and build our energy independence.
The Kremlin is scathing of unprecedented sanctions being imposed against Russia by the EU and the West's policy of sending billions of euro worth of deadly weapons to Ukraine. Due to the energy and refugee crises, the EU is facing economic ruin, some experts warn. It means the EU project is under threat like never before because hard-pressed citizens might turn against the political establishment. It's for this reason that many analysts are saying EU leaders might look back on their handling of the Ukraine-Russia question with enormous regret. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
With the re-election of President Emmanuel Macron, France's mainstream media has stopped worrying about fascism and started to honestly discuss the state of the country. A France divided is the most common headline. In 2017, Macron promised to not give France a reason to vote for the extremes of the political spectrum, but the far right and the far left have both grown to new highs.
It's a good thing Macron was re-elected. We need a young, efficient, pro-European president with a long-term vision. I'm surprised at the high score for the National Front, but in their economic program, they forget that it's the bosses who are in charge of salaries and not the president.
Le Pen won just 5% of the vote in the capital, while out of 101 departments, she carried 30 of them, mostly rural. She secured just one department in 2017. 80% of voters described the presidential campaign as being of poor quality, and few desired a rematch of 2017.
I didn't vote in the second round. In the first round, I voted for third-place finisher Jean-Luc Mélenchon and decided to abstain. I think it's better that Macron won instead of Le Pen, who is too extreme right for me.
Macron's problem is that, once again, he can't claim his win signifies a broad mandate for his proposals. Subtract 39% of the total electorate due to abstention and purposely spoiled ballots, and Macron's 58% of the vote falls to just 35% of the electorate. If we fairly assume that, like in 2017, 43% of his voters only did so to block Le Pen, then just 20% of the total electorate chose Macron for his policies or personality. That's a drop of 4 points from 2017. If Macron continues to rule as if his policies don't need a broad popular mandate, then France's permanent social unrest seems likely to continue. A Le Pen victory would have set off immediate protests, but for now, a calm resignation is reigning. However, few expect the Paris street or the rural roundabout to remain quiet for very long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of this international conference that drew political figures and activists from across the world to Tehran to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israel's occupation.
The message of the conference here is for expressing unity with our Palestinian brothers and sisters who are suffering and who are struggling for their independence and their sovereignty.
The centrality of the issue of Palestine for the Muslim world is what we want to remind some of the Arab states that ignored this fact and contemptibly normalized their ties with the criminal regime of Israel despite the will of their nations. Some Arab leaders must be ashamed even more now when we see that the Israelis are attacking Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound site since early April, with the onset of the holy month of Ramadan, which coincided with Jewish Passover. Last week, more than 150 Palestinian worshippers were injured when Israeli forces stormed the compound in the occupied city of Al-Quds. The regime has pressed ahead with its violence at the Flashpoint site and has been cracking down on solidarity protests throughout the occupied West Bank.
What is happening today in Palestine has been repeated for the last 72 years. Added to that, that today the crimes of Israel has exceeded all the human rights and all war crimes. UNESCO itself has declared that Al-Aqsa Mosque is an Islamic sanctity, is an Islamic place. It has nothing related to the Jewish religion. What is the relevance to the extreme Zionist Jewish settlers to get into the mosque and pray over there? There is no relation to them over there. What we want today is that the international community has to understand that Israel has violated the freedom of worshipping rights.
This conference is held ahead of the International Quds Day, a global pro-Palestine rally that takes place every year on the last Friday of the month of Ramadan. Activists here regard Quds Day as an opportunity to shed light on the Israeli crimes in Palestine and hope that it would instigate the international community to take action in support of Palestinians.
Delegates here say Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, calling on Muslims worldwide to participate in the International Quds Day en masse. They say this is the only way to bring the Palestinian cause to light, amid attempts by Tel Aviv to sweep its crimes under the rug. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The toxic output from fires is dangerous, contributing to an estimated loss of more than 15,000 lives in the United States each year. Some scientists say that number will double by the end of the century. We'll prepare for you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled Study Says Wildfire Smoke in U.S. Pacific Northwest Erasing Reductions in Emissions. Scientists at the National Center for Atmospheric Research have found that billowing black smoke that has cloaked the U.S. Pacific Northwest during wildfire disasters in past years has caused atmospheric carbon monoxide levels to spike, with the contaminants offsetting recent reductions in emissions. As the American West faces increasing threats from big blazes that are fueled by a climate that's growing warmer and drier, researchers have documented the impact of smoke on public health. But scientists are increasingly finding that the wildfires may be part of a feedback loop that could accelerate the changing conditions, and that health impacts, officials have long warned, could worsen with climate crisis, may in fact already be there. Dr. Rebecca Buchholz, a project scientist at National Center for Atmospheric Research, said, "Our research contributes to the growing body of research that shows that fires, in particular Pacific Northwest region fires, are becoming more important for North American air quality." Dr. Rebecca Buchholz explained, "Looking at carbon monoxide, a trace gas emitted during fires, researchers analyzed the impact on atmospheric chemistry from 2002 to 2018. Though the scientists relied on carbon monoxide data to guide them, the contaminant also provided a framework to understand how other sources of pollution might be tied to the flames. Her team, which also included scientists from across the country and around the globe, found that the dangerous pollutant peaks in August, when wildfires are typically raging in the region, but dips during other months. She said the deviation from the annual cycle is telling us that fires are compromising the ability of the atmosphere to self-clean. Globally, carbon monoxide concentrations receded by half a percentage point a year over the 16-year period of the study. But across North America, the scientists found that August was an outlier. Carbon monoxide levels in the atmosphere follow a seasonal flow, driven to ebb and increase through a photochemical process. Prior to 2011, the regions fell in line with this pattern, and levels of the pollutants peaked in the spring and waned in late summer. In a more recent period, the researchers analyzed from 2012 to 2018, a new trend began to emerge. In August, when carbon monoxide was expected to be driven to its lowest points, there were instead spikes. The scientists found that this not only affects atmospheric carbon monoxide, but was found closer to the Earth's surface as well. The deviation from the worldwide trend was strongest in the Pacific Northwest, where wildfire risks are high during the month of August. But the effect lingered in data collected in areas across the country and into the northeast of the North American continent. The study's findings were supported by four different global fire emission inventories, which consistently showed carbon monoxide fire emissions peaked in the Pacific Northwest in the month of August. Data from two other inventories that catalogue emissions from human activity show carbon monoxide was not increasing in the region during the study period, helping the researchers rule out other causes of the August surge and its spread. A growing body of research has shown how wildfires raging across the western United States can impact the air locally and afar, with the potential to affect millions across the country. Last year, the sun glowed ominously red as far away as New York City, shrouded in haze from land burning on the other side of the country. In 2020, which had the worst wildfire season on record, levels of the most dangerous type of air pollution rose by 7% in the United States, even after the pandemic shutdowns delivered steep reductions in fossil fuel use. Toxic output from wildfires is dangerous, contributing to an estimated loss of more than 15,000 lives in the United States each year. Some scientists say that number will double by the end of the century. According to a separate study published last year, smoke from western wildfires has also been attributed to up to 5,900 asthma-related emergency department visits a year. Nearly three-quarters of these visits and hospital admissions tied to smoke inhalation were outside the western United States. While some questions still remain about the connection between ignitions and climate crisis, it's clear that spiking temperatures are spurring the desiccation of landscapes and priming them to burn. Wildfires are still predominantly caused by people. Land management, including the use of prescribed fire, which doesn't burn with the same amount of intensity or smoke, plays an important role in mitigating the potential for disasters. But as the western United States warms, bigger blazes are expected to follow. This study shows that this could have a more lasting effect. Noting that big questions about the specifics of the relationship between the two still remains, researcher Dr. Rebecca Buchholz said, "There is definitely a feedback loop between wildfires and climate." But her research shows that the conflagrations have a compounding effect on bad air quality and that it has the potential to affect millions of people across the American continent. She said it will be important to start looking at August as a significantly changing month when it comes to contaminants.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. People around the world have marked International Quds Day in a show of solidarity with the Palestinians. The annual event is aimed at raising awareness about the plight of the Palestinian people, whose land has been occupied for more than seven decades. Demonstrators also take this opportunity to condemn Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. In a speech on this day, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said all of Palestine has today turned into a stage for resistance, dealing a death blow to all plots aimed at compromise with the Israeli regime. International Quds Day, declared by the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, is held annually on the last Friday of Ramadan. The event is a show of unity among the Muslim community in denunciation of Israel's atrocities on occupied land. On tonight's Spotlight, we have attorney and political analyst Zakir Ahmad Tamayit, joining us from Johannesburg. And activist from the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. Mick Napier, joining us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Mayat in Johannesburg. International Quds Day provides an opportunity for people around the world to express support for the Palestinian cause. How important is a day like this to raise awareness about the Palestinian cause and the ongoing illegal military occupation of Palestine?
Well, I'd like to begin by thanking you for the opportunity to appear and share this platform with dear brother and guest. I think the importance of Quds Day cannot be overemphasized. The Day of Quds, as demarcated by the late Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, stood as a symbol to remind every free, loving, justice-loving person around the world that the people of Palestine are subjected to some of the worst atrocities under the hands of the Zionist occupiers. And it is also a day of recognizing the true extent of the Zionist project, which is a settler colonial project that practices apartheid. And it is on these days that we remind the rest of the world of what this project truly is. It is a project that belongs to the dustbin of history and should not be present. And today, as you see in the footage that has been played and that will be visible on numerous social media platforms, the entire world is on one side, and it seems that those that support apartheid, colonialism, and ethnic superiority, the minority, is now in a small boat, slowly moving towards the cliff and over the waterfall.
Mr. Mick Napier, in Edinburgh, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says the entirety of Palestine has today turned into a stage for resistance, dealing a death blow to all plots aimed at compromise with Israel. If you may please elaborate on the comments by Ayatollah Khamenei.
Compromise with the Zionist project and the state that it has created in the middle of the Middle East is impossible. because the Zionist project is not one to oppress and to exploit the Palestinian people. It's to do that on the road to expelling the Palestinians so that they can be replaced by colonizers, by Zionist Jews from around the world. So compromise is not possible. I mean, when we talk about the terrible crimes that are being committed against the Palestinians, the massive incarceration, the house demolitions, the shoot to kill, the siege of Gaza, I mean, grotesque crimes. The fact is that these are not something that we claim to be happening. They're happening in the full view of the world. And it's important to remember that every Palestinian knows that Zionism spells their doom, that it doesn't want to live alongside Palestinians. It never did. When they were extremely weak, when the Zionists were very weak, they still didn't want to live alongside Palestinians, but they were protected by the British. When they became strong enough to dominate the Palestinians militarily, still the same situation. They don't want any Palestinians to remain in Palestine. So because everybody knows this, every Israeli knows this, every Palestinian knows this, it gives the struggle a particularly sharp edge. And in addition to that, we have to say that the nature of Israel's link to America, and in the past to Britain, but now primarily to America, means that Israel is very much an extension of American power into the Middle East, seen by America as a tool to be used to chastise, to defeat, to attack neighbors who refuse to accept American domination. In 1967, it seems like ancient history, but it's not. Israel destroyed, really, Arab nationalism in the shape of Nasser and similar movements, which wanted Middle Eastern people to control Middle Eastern resources. So Israel is a threat to the people of Palestine. It's an existential threat, but it will always be a threat as long as it exists to all the people of the region, because that's the nature of its relationship to the USA. And the USA has said if they didn't have Israel, they would need two aircraft carriers off the coast of Palestine. So that's the nature of Israel. That nature has never changed.
Sure.
It's always relied upon the dominant imperial power. It still does, and it always will have to do, because however powerful Israel becomes, it's still surrounded by 400 million people, Arabs and other peoples of the Middle East, who know what it's doing. So that nature of Israel vindicates the view that you cannot compromise with Zionism,
right,
that it is a forum for where the fate of the Middle East in part will be decided.
Mr. Mayet, Ayatollah Khamenei praised the resistance of the Palestinian people, stressing that they are united in continuing the struggle against the Israeli regime. How important is the issue of resistance? Many observers believe that resistance is the only viable option for the Palestinians. Do you see it in that light as well?
Most definitely. I think one would have to be delusional to argue that soft power is the only answer to a brutal Zionist regime. South Africa has a long history of this as well. In 1961, the first democratic president of South Africa, the late Nelson Mandela, said a very similar thing, that some believe, and I'm paraphrasing, some believe that it is futile to continue to speak nonviolence to a regime whose response is only savage attacks on an innocent and unarmed population. The Palestinians have been resisting. The First Intifada was a relatively peaceful uprising using stones, and we know that Israel's response has been to break the bones of Palestinians. The Second Intifada was an armed intifada, and now what we are seeing is a complete new balance that has been established. It has been referred to by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, the General Secretary, and we see this also being mentioned by numerous figures today on the Day of Quds. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is 100% correct when he gives us this guidance that Palestine is going to be liberated through armed resistance and the joint actions of the peace-loving world. These are boycotts, these are sanctions, but the truth is that Israel is now in an equation where they are fully aware that if they transgress beyond a certain point, beyond a line, there will be a regional war in defense of Al-Quds, and it will spell out the disaster and end and the complete destruction of the Zionist enterprise.
Sure. Mick Napier, over the past 7 decades, Israeli atrocities in occupied Palestine have drawn condemnation from the likes of the United Nations, numerous rights groups, but these condemnations, however, have done little to force Israel to change course. Why have these Israeli atrocities gone unabated for so long?
Because Israel is a very valued resource for NATO, for the US and its allies in the Middle East. It can be relied upon, as no other regime can be relied upon, to work at the behest and on behalf of Western powers. Look, America, the CIA has carried out various studies which says that they don't actually believe the Saudi regime or the Gulf Emirates are stable enough to be relied upon going into the indefinite future, because they can adopt policies in line with American policy, but their peoples are hostile. The Egyptian regime gets billions in US aid, but its people remain bitterly hostile to what America and Israel is doing. Israel is different from the other regimes which are allied with America. Because it's a settler colonial project, because its aim is to displace the native people and replace them with colonists from around the world, and because it has incurred hatred, the justified hatred of the people across the entire region, it must rely upon America. That link is something that is very different from the links with other regimes. So therefore, it gets a green light. We thought that it was some people thought it was a special green light from Donald Trump, but actually Biden has carried on pretty much the same policies, moving the US embassy to Al-Quds and so on. So there's a real continuum between Obama, Trump, Biden and so on, and that continuity, the billions continuing to flow in military aid to Israel, tells us that it's independent of any government. It's very much in line with the interests of the American ruling elite, and therefore they're allowed to commit these grotesque crimes. America has said that it will take direct action, sanctions against the International Criminal Court if Israel is taken in front of it. The bandit through the illegality, that the criminality, if you like, is not hidden, it comes out into the open. And this would not be the case if Israel was a failure, and that's where the future hope lies. Because Israel was defeated very clearly in the view of the whole world in 2006 when they invaded Lebanon, because it was driven out of Lebanon, because it has been unable to crush Palestinian resistance in Gaza, the West Bank, or East Jerusalem, or even inside 48, the price of Israel for that failure, sure, would be to hasten its defeat. So yes, it gets a green light from Washington and the EU and London, but that's only because so far it has been able to crush opposition, and that seems to be coming to an end.
Mr. Mayor, in Johannesburg, the Israeli wave of violence and crimes against Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque has continued for weeks now. Give us your perspective on the increase of violence against the worshippers during the holy fasting month of Ramadan. What are the motives behind this, in your opinion?
There was a very interesting article that was published on an Israeli defense site in 2014, speaking about the importance of Ramadan within the context of the Islamic resistance movement on the Qawam al-Islamiyya. And they had always stated that the greatest risk to the Zionist enterprise is during the month of Ramadan. That is when there is the greatest amount of cohesion, and historically, the successes and liberation of Al-Quds is vested in the month of Ramadan. We know that numerous battles have taken place for the liberation of Palestine, and it has a very strong link to Ramadan. The Zionist enterprise at the moment is caught between a very difficult rock and a hard place. They have the settlers that are internal and that are causing so much of havoc that they are having difficulty controlling their own population. And then they have the resistance that is on the other side. So if we look at what has happened, is they had plan the flag march to go through certain areas that had been stopped. They had attempted to gain access to Masjid al-Aqsa that had stopped. The Zionist enterprise has taken certain steps back. And yes, there is still aggression against Palestinians. However, they were forced to take a step back and not launch a massive incursion and war in Gaza or continue with large-scale operations within the West Bank. We've seen limited operations within Jenin and a few other environments, but not on the scale that you would expect. Now, it comes out from the INSS, which is one of the think tanks of the Israeli military machine. They say simply that we have no options but to make a show of what we are doing. Jenin's operation is just to subdue our own internal criticism from our own population. So what we have is a Zionist regime that is caught between its agenda of consistent terrorism towards the Palestinians versus the real and tangible threat that if they transgress, there will be a regional war, and it will spell the end of the Zionist enterprise. Everybody sees it the same way the nationalist government here in South Africa saw it during the apartheid era. Now the Zionist enterprise is seeing it themselves. The entire world, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Beth Salem, the Al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, everybody is calling for the same thing, the dismantlement of the Zionist enterprise. And I believe that we are extremely close to seeing this happen within our lifetime.
Meek Napier, as Israelis expand ties with some Arab governments, grassroots Palestinian reactions are increasing. Do you think that this is a clear sign from Palestinians showing how they feel about these deals, about Israel trying to legitimize the occupation through these U.S.-crafted normalization deals?
Yes. I mean, there is a sense of desperation. There is a sense that these regimes have really gone to bed with Israel. They're trading. They're actually buying weapons from Israel, which have been tested and perfected against the Palestinian people. These regimes are almost literally trading in Palestinian blood or weapons which have been steeped in Palestinian blood. Therefore, there is this sense of desperation. But also, they are living in a pressure cooker. Our friend from South Africa well applies the experience of that defeat, of the defeat of that apartheid, to the current situation in the Middle East. The Israelis are driven by the project to try to expel as many Palestinians as possible, as quickly as possible. But they're very alert to how this plays out in Washington and even in Brussels and London. So they know that there's limitations in what they can do. Can I just say, obviously, the struggle for liberation has to be the act of the Palestinians themselves and their allies across the region. But an auxiliary role was played in South Africa by the international boycott movement. It helped. It helped to isolate that apartheid regime. And I'm reminded of the words of an Israeli ambassador, Ron Prosser, when he left London to take up his ambassadorship at the UN on behalf of the apartheid state. When he was leaving, he said, "Look, we're in trouble." He wrote a major article in a right-wing paper to say that Israel's relations with the political elites in Britain were very good, but in terms of public opinion, he compared Britain to a high-rise building. He said every other floor of the building we find toxic anti-Israel hatred, which is what people know what's happening, and the general population in Britain and across Europe is already very hostile to Israel. Our task is to contribute to the defeat of Zionism in the way that Ron Prosser said, because he said if that feeling intensifies and is channeled, it can cause problems for state-to-state relations, which is also what happened with South Africa. Ultimately, despite Thatcher, despite Ronald Reagan being great fans of the apartheid regime in many ways, they were finally forced to take some action against that monstrosity. And the same process can play out with apartheid Israel as well. So Israel's strong in many ways, but it's got feet of clay in the sense that it's already deeply unpopular. The Palestinians, if I may just make a final point, the Palestinian resistance is successful in many ways. But one of the ways we have to see it is that it has already won a decisive battle. By their resistance, they have made Israel deeply unpopular in the eyes of the world. And that's not trivial, because that can be channeled. We already see people in Britain driving out Israeli arms companies. We see in the past, companies that were selling weapons to Israel have been smashed up by protesters, and juries have supported those who've done so. They haven't supported the arms companies. So there are weaknesses there that we need to exploit strategically going forward.
Mr. Mayet, how do you explain the clear inconsistency of the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestine?
The structure of international law is very curious because it allows for these rogue states, I would say barbaric states, satanic states, such as the United States, to launch wars of terror across the Middle East, kill millions of people, and still preach that they are fighting for democracy and freedom. And now we see them playing out their war with Russia and Ukraine. So when you look at the standards, and I think Mr. Napier is 100% correct, they have the support of these countries, such as the United States, such as the UK, and certain European countries, which have committed their own atrocities. So it becomes very strange for us to ask those who have committed mass murder amongst brown people to now stand on the side of the Palestinians as they prop up the state of Israel. What this has exposed is the fraudulent levels of human rights that exist. It's human rights for certain people, not human rights for all people. And therefore, it becomes a very clear indicator for the peoples of the world to reestablish a balance of power. And this is what is happening at the moment. From a unipolar world where the United States dictates, it is now changing, and the regional powers, including the Islamic Republic of Iran and many others, are now readdressing these problems, and we believe that in a very short period of time, we will be seeing a dispensation that allows for true human rights, freedoms, and justice to prevail. But this has exposed the fraudulence of the so-called human rights doctrine, which is only applicable to some and not others.
All right. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, attorney and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayet, joining us from Johannesburg, and a special thanks to activists from Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mick Napier, joining us from Edinburgh. And also thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
Global military expenditures surpassed $2 trillion for the first time ever last year, with the United States spending more on its war-making capacity than the next nine nations combined, according to new data published recently. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Global Military Spending Tops $2 Trillion for First Time in History. Here's the story. Global military expenditures surpassed $2 trillion for the first time ever last year, with the United States spending more on its war-making capacity than the next nine nations combined, according to new data published recently. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI, reported an all-time high of $2.1 trillion in worldwide military spending for 2021, a 0.7% increase from 2020 levels and the seventh straight year of increased expenditures. Even amid the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic, world military spending hit record levels, SIPRI senior researcher Diego Lopez da Silva said in a statement, adding, there was a slowdown in the rate of real terms growth due to inflation. In nominal terms, however, military spending grew by 6.1%. Tori Bateman, Policy Advocacy Coordinator at the American Friends Service Committee, a Quaker group, said that this year we've seen how military spending fails to keep us safe. It's shameful that governments, especially the U.S., continue to destabilize our world with more weapons while failing to address climate change, public health, and other true global crises. She added, it's time for the U.S. and world leaders everywhere to cut military spending and commit to solving our problems for real. With $801 billion, or 38% of total global military spending, the United States spent more in 2021 than the next nine nations combined. China, $293 billion, India, $76.6 billion, the United Kingdom, $68.4 billion, Russia, $65.9 billion, France, $56.6 billion, Germany, $56 billion, Saudi Arabia, $55.6 billion, Japan, $54.1 billion, and South Korea, $50.2 billion. U.S. funding for military research and development increased by nearly a quarter between 2012 and 2021, while arms procurement expenditures fell by 6.4% over that same period, a trend that suggests that the United States is focusing more on next-generation technologies, according to SIPRI researcher Alexandra Marksteiner. The U.S. government has repeatedly stressed the need to preserve the U.S. military's technological edge over strategic competitors, she added. The latest SIPRI analysis comes weeks after U.S. President Joe Biden rejected progressive lawmakers' calls for Pentagon spending cuts and asked Congress to greenlight more than $813 in new military spending for the next fiscal year, a $31 billion increase from current levels. That amount includes nearly $146 billion for the procurement of new weaponry, including Lockheed Martin F-35 fighter jets, Northrop Grumman B-21 bombers, and Virginia-class nuclear-powered fast attack submarines manufactured by General Dynamics and Huntington Ingalls Industries. We'll be right back. The new SIPRI report also comes as some of the largest U.S. weapons makers are gearing up for what is expected to be a big earnings week for the West's response to the Russian operation in Ukraine, providing Ukrainian forces with billions of dollars in weaponry, fuels, arms, industry profits. Lindsay Kashigarian, director of the National Priorities Project at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies, recently noted that spending 12 times as much on our military. It just deprived us of resources at home. Even during a pandemic, supply chain crisis and painful inflation will put more resources into the military and war than public health, education, green jobs, affordable housing, scientific and medical research, childcare, and every other domestic need combined, she wrote. This is special treatment for the Pentagon recklessly squanders precious resources that could be used to strengthen our families and communities against our compounding crisis at home. Last week, an analysis by Indeed These Times and Zain Rezvi at the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen revealed that the United States has spent 7.5 times more money on nuclear weapons than on global COVID-19 vaccine donations. Despite Biden's pledge that America will become the arsenal of vaccines as we were the arsenal of democracy during the Second World War, as he claimed. Kashigarian asked, what's keeping us safe? Is it maintaining this huge nuclear stockpile or delivering these vaccines?